Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Monday, the 4th of March, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett, and here's Carol with our first story.
Thank you, Jeff. And from the local page, driver rams two Bettendorf police cars. This article is by Thomas Geyer. A Davenport man is facing charges after Bettendorf police say he fled a traffic stop and rammed two of their patrol vehicles early Saturday. Wade Jamil Jones, Sr., 37, is charged with one count each of first-degree criminal mischief and eluding with a speed of more than 25 mile per hour second offense. Each of the charges is a Class C felony under Iowa law that carries a prison sentence of 10 years. Jones is also charged with possession of a controlled substance, third offense, marijuana, a Class D felony that carries a prison sentence of 5 years, and driving while barred, and an aggravated misdemeanor that carries a prison sentence of 2 years. According to the arrest affidavits filed by Bettendorf Police Officer Sheldon Phipps, Jones was driving a 2008 Buick Enclave in the 900 block of Grant Street with unlawfully tinted windows and no registration plates. Phipps conducted a traffic stop on the Enclave at 2:55 a.m. on Saturday. While speaking with Jones, Phipps said he noticed a strong smell of alcohol and that Jones had bloodshot, watery eyes. According to the affidavits, Jones refused to provide Phipps with identification, and he continued to tell Phipps he needed to check the temporary license tag. Jones then sped away west on River Drive, reaching speeds of 80 miles per hour in a 40-mile-per-hour zone. Bettendorf officers pursued a short distance before breaking off the chase for safety reasons. Jones turned into the village of East Davenport and then crashed his vehicle into two parked vehicles on Davenport's East 11th Street. Officers were able to locate the crash and attempted to box Jones' car in, but Jones rammed through two Bettendorf squad cars to get away. While attempting to perform another traffic stop, Jones fled his vehicle on foot. When officers caught up to him, Jones fought with officers and Phipps subdued Jones with his taser. Jones was taken into custody. According to the affidavits, officers seized 17.05 grams of marijuana from Jones and learned he is barred from driving in Iowa until February 17, 2029. His license also is suspended in Iowa for non-payment of fines. The temporary license tag on the Enclave was also fraudulently filled out, expiring in 2023. Jones was taken to Genesis Medical Center East Campus, Davenport, for evaluation. A blood draw was done for toxicology purposes to determine his blood alcohol content. Jones could be facing a charge of operating while intoxicated, depending on the result of the blood analysis. Jones is also facing traffic charges of reckless driving, fraudulent use of registration, and driving under suspension. During a first appearance on the charges held Sunday in Scott County District Court, Magistrate Catherine Carty scheduled preliminary hearing for March 12th. Jones was being held Sunday night in the Scott County Jail on a cash-only bond of $3,000. Here's Jeff.
STEAM Expo connects learning to life. About 600 people attended the expo on Saturday. Peter Eliopoulos, age 4, worked with the spaghetti and small marshmallows placed on a table by Russell Construction in the gym at Bettendorf Middle School. Peter made several construction designs with the simple materials, occasionally looking at what other children were building, but mostly concentrating on his own design. Peter's father, Sam Eliopoulos, said he likes to do stuff like this, but he's never worked with these materials before. This is the longest we've stayed in one spot today. He's really enjoying it. Peter and his father were among 600 people who attended the STEAM, STEAM, Expo on Saturday that ran from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Bettendorf Middle School. There were 32 stations throughout the school where adults and children could learn about a subject in science, technology, engineering, the arts, and mathematics. Lee Marbach, the project manager with Russell Construction, said the exercise using the simple ingredients is really just about experimenting and trial and error, and that engineering concept of instead of being the right answer, how do you continue to try and learn and improve? The idea is, if they want to build the tallest tower, how does that happen? As he watched the children build, Marbach said that there are studies that show that in this spaghetti and marshmallow example, children outperform adults consistently because the children aren't afraid to try new things and trial and error. HNI Corporation, an office furniture manufacturer in Muscatine, had three robots set up for the people to drive. Cones to maneuver around were set up for one of the robots, while a curved roadway was set up for the other. The third robot was used to push a box around. Kids and adults lined up to drive the robots. Candace Jepkes, an industrial engineer out of the University of Iowa, who's been with HNI for 27 years, said the robots were very popular. "We have a Women in STEM group, and we do school outreach for bringing up the next generation in STEM," Jepkes said. "We partner with the Fire Island Robotics team from Muscatine High School, and they make these robots that we take around to the schools. These have been very well received, and we do them from kindergarten through grade 6, she added. "When the kids take a tour of our factories, they can see the big robots pushing the boxes around." Bettendorf Police Lieutenant Andrew Champion and Police Officer Eric Poirier were showing how science and technology are used by police. They had a baseball throw set up and were clocking the speeds of the balls using a handheld radar. "This is the third year we've done the speed measurement with the radar," Champion said. "We try to represent a ball speed to a vehicle speed because they're very typical of what in-town speeds would be, and it just helps kids equate to that." The radar is using a light wave to bounce off the baseball, and it slows kids to see how the technology can be used in different ways, he said. Amid all the science and technology were the arts, including writing and the use of one's imagination. Sarah Elgation, a marketing and programs director for the Midwest Writing Center, pointed out that nothing we do in our leisure time is not written. The TV shows are written, the video games are written, the music is written, the books are written, she said. There's no escaping the written word. It's just remembering that's where it all came from. There was more to see and do, with many of the families saying they come every year. Among the many activities included Mike McKean of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, teaching children about how the locks and dams work in the Mississippi River. Dave Marcia, director of the Wapsie River Environmental Education Center, had a great horned owl that he used to teach children about the raptors. St. Ambrose University had their physical therapy and chemistry students teaching different aspects of science. Parker Audiology taught about the world of earwax. Metronet taught about fiber optics. John Deere had welding, while the Quad City Steam Wheelers taught people how to throw a spiral pass. There was slime fun with the Bettendorf Girl Scouts, while the Boy Scouts had several exhibits, including lighting cotton balls on fire using flint and steel. There were also exhibits on gardening, the watershed, veterinary medicine, screen printing, beekeeping, clean energy, and a planetarium show, among many others. Griffin Rindler, age 7, and Easton Weil, age 6, were in the 3M room making bouncy balls. Joshua Varghese of 3M said they were there to teach the children about polymers and density and solubility by making bouncy balls and lava lamps. To make bouncy balls, he said, they use water, glue, borax, and cornstarch. Holding a string of small beads, Varghese explained that these beads represent our short-chain polymers, which is our glue and cornstarch solution. And when we mix these with borax and water, you get longer-chain polymers, and that gives it different properties, and that makes it less slimy and bouncy. The lava lamps were made with water, vegetable oil, and food coloring. When antacid tablets are dropped into the mixture, it made for a show that wowed the children. Rachel Dirks, an MTSS facilitator, or multi-tiered system of supports for the Bettendorf Community School District, said bringing together businesses and service organizations to talk about their varied work allows the day's guests to see where all these categories fit into life and help our students see that there are a lot of opportunities to apply what they're learning in the classroom in the real world. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And the Rock Island Police Department is holding a naming contest for its new K-9 officer. Members of the community have until 5 p.m. Wednesday to submit possible names on the Facebook pages of the Rock Island Police Department and the City of Rock Island. Suggested names should be placed in the comment sections of the posts about the contest. The male, 14-month-old Belgian Malinois German Shepherd mix from the Cedar Creek Kennels in Mammoth, Illinois, will replace K-9 Sparky Jackson. Sparky Jackson died unexpectedly after a medical procedure in September. An anonymous donor in support of police K-9 programs contributed $10,000 toward the purchase and training of a new dog for the police department. Officer Alex Bowman will again serve as K-9 handler and will go through 10 weeks of training with the dog at Cedar Creek Kennels. The dog must be named before training begins at the end of March. Police department personnel will vote on the winning name, which will be revealed during the March 11th City Council meeting. Jeff?
13-year-old struck by a car suffers minor injuries. A 13-year-old boy suffered minor injuries Friday when he was struck by a vehicle while running across a Moline street in between vehicles, Police Chief Darren Galt said. Galt said that at 3:29 p.m., officers were sent to the 1800 block of 48th Street Place to investigate a report of a traffic crash involving a pedestrian. The boy was on the west sidewalk and then ran mid-block east across 48th Street Place in between vehicles. A Cadillac XTS was northbound on 48th Street Place at the same time. The boy crossed the street between a southbound Metrolink bus, or behind a southbound Metrolink bus. When the boy entered the northbound lane, he was struck by the Cadillac. The driver of the car stopped immediately, as did several witnesses. Moline Fire Department paramedics arrived on the scene and transported the boy to a local hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. The Moline Police Department Traffic Unit is investigating the incident. Galt said that no citations were issued and no arrests were made on the scene. Galt said the boy was released from the hospital later on Friday evening. Carol?
And Rock Island Milan school leaders talked survey participation, proposed policy changes and hired new boys' soccer coach. With only board president Terrell Williams absent, Tuesday's meeting kicked off with a board report. The school board members highlighted the following district events and achievements. First, Jason Ressler noted Rock Island High School's two wrestling state champions, Truth Vassie and Andrew Marquis. Second, Gary Rao shared data from the Black Hawk Area Special Education District, noting 67 Rock Island Milan students are in the program as of January 30th. AIDS assessment survey had a high degree of satisfaction with the program, but also cited a shortage of social work, psychology, occupational therapy, and vision itinerant services. The district's current Head Start program enrollment is 255, and many of these students are meeting or exceeding school readiness expectations, Rowe said. In the procedural Rock Island Education Association report, President Andrew Haynes urged district leaders to remove identifying information on Rock Island Milan's biannual satisfaction survey. Since some questions on the survey ask for identifying information due to some school sample size, Haynes said some are reluctant to participate. During public comment, several district parents spoke against proposed changes to Board Policy 730, student assignment and intra-district transfer. As previously reported, the proposed policy is driven by enrollment growth at specific buildings or grade levels, as this growth causes concerns with student-to-teacher ratios, crowding, and limited transfer options. If enacted, district leaders say this policy would allow Rock Island Milan to prevent oversized classrooms and better utilize open seats throughout the district. If enacted, this policy would allow Rock Island Milan to prevent oversized classrooms and better utilize open seats throughout the district, district officials say. Jeff, back to you.
Continuing with school board reports, the MCVSB discusses strategic plans and financials. Moline Coal Valley school leaders approved procedural financials and talked strategic vision setting this week. With all members present, the board began Monday's quick meeting with unanimous consent agenda approval. Next, they do the same for the meeting's sole regular action item. That is a resolution to hold a public hearing on Monday, April 8 at 6 p.m. for an amended fiscal year 2023-24 budget per Illinois Code compliance. These changes are primarily due to new contracts, construction projects, and health insurance claims increases, which Moline Coal Valley officials must properly reflect in the district's fiscal year 23 annual financial report. The public hearing will take place in the black box of Moline High School's Bartlett Performance Arts Center, located at 3600 Avenue of the Cities. In Superintendent Rachel Savage's report, she noted continued stakeholder engagement and vision-setting work for the district's Portrait of an Educator initiative. Most recently, she said student participants identified 25 competencies they feel are most important to see in Moline Coal Valley educators. Students will focus on narrowing this list down to 10 competencies next session, Savage said. This follows Moline Coal Valley's similar Portrait of a Graduate work, which concluded this past fall and is part of the district's strategic planning PACE, that's People, Achievement, Community, and Environment, PACE, goals for the 2023-24 school year. Savage said around 70 students are participating in Portrait of an Educator, representing each high school grade level. She also noted continued PACE work in other areas, such as professional development and instructional workthroughs for staff. In seeking to meet these goals, Savage said district leaders have been digging into findings from the annual state-backed Five Essentials survey. By April, Savage said district leaders plan to close out PaceWork and will evaluate its progress, that is, which goals were met, and next strategic planning steps. Before closing her report, Savage also noted an increase of students meeting math and literacy targets. This is particularly exciting, she said, as Moline Coal Valley implemented a new math curriculum this school year. During other procedural reports, board member Jason Farrell noted a recent Gray Matters Collective event at Augustana College, which featured suicide prevention speakers, therapy dogs, local mental health resources, remembrance tables, a student panel, performances, and more. Reflecting on the district's Gray Matters chapter, Farrell called Moline Coal Valley students and educators forward-thinking in terms of mental health awareness and advocacy. Echoing this, student board member Abigail Greenlee said she appreciates how teachers aren't afraid to have difficult discussions with students about mental health. She also noted recent Moline High School athletic achievements, namely senior Marianne Nadai clinching the 155-pound Illinois State Wrestling Championship title. After her report, board members took time to thank Greenlee for her leadership and involvement. Following closed session, the board unanimously voted to authorize District CFO Vince Gallo to negotiate a property purchase at 2121 47th Street in Moline, a former IH Mississippi Valley Credit Union building. As previously reported, Moline Coal Valley leaders seek to sell the Allendale facility and relocate to the 47th Street building. Currently housing the district's centralized office departments, Allendale is one of three district buildings over 100 years old, along with Logan and Willard Elementary Schools, located at 1619 11th Avenue in Moline. For all reports and discussions in full, watch Monday's meeting live stream on the Moline Television YouTube channel. Carol?
And a renewable energy forum for Moline homeowners will be held March 9th in Moline. Progressive Action for Common Good, which is known as PACG, announced it's sponsoring a forum on renewable energy focusing on how to access federal and state incentives available to help finance home projects. The forum will be held at the Western Illinois University QC campus at 3300 River Drive in Moline, room 111 in Riverfront Hall, from 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. on Saturday, March 9th. The forum is free, but registration is required online at www.pacgqc.org. The forum is co-sponsored by Western Illinois University, WQPT, WVIK, and the Citizens Climate Lobby. The forum is geared toward anyone who would like to save money on their electric bill, reduce their carbon footprint, or become energy independent. Attendees will learn the pros and cons of solar power, air source heat pumps, and geothermal energy, as well as how to choose reliable contractors. Presenters will include participants from the Citizens Utility Board of Illinois and the Geothermal Alliance of Illinois, with Mark Rodolfi, managing editor of the North Scott Press, moderating the presentations. Exhibitors will include local vendors. Jeff?
The Start Their Week Off Right column is Screenings Can Prevent Colorectal Cancer. Rising colorectal cancer rates in the U.S., particularly in younger Americans, signal the importance of staying on a screening schedule. Are you age 45 or older and putting off a colonoscopy? Several facts may motivate you to get back on track. Genesis gastroenterologist Andy Liu, MD, reinforces several key messages during Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month in March. First, colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer-related death. Best way to treat colorectal cancer is to treat it early. Colorectal cancer screenings can help detect cancers early and save lives. Second, colorectal cancer is one of the most preventable cancers. The best test is a screening colonoscopy, which allows an instrument to examine your colon under sedation. Third, colonoscopies can prevent colon cancer by removing polyps early. This significantly helps to reduce the risk of colorectal cancer. Polyps are growths in the colon that have a risk of becoming colon cancer. During a colonoscopy, your doctor uses a thin, flexible tube with a light and lens on it to travel the 5-foot length of the colon to look for polyps and remove them. The colonoscopy reduces cancer rates by removing polyps before they become cancerous, making it better than stool tests, which can only detect cancers, Liu said. A missed or delayed screening gives colon cancer a chance to grow and spread before symptoms appear. Age 45 is the new 50 when it comes to screening. While most frequently found in older people, colorectal cancer cases have been rising in younger people. This prompted the American Cancer Society and U.S. Preventive Services Task Force to issue new recommendations for people at average risk of colorectal cancer to start regular screening at age 45. If you have a family history of colorectal cancer, however, your doctor may recommend you start screening earlier, even if is age 40. Most colorectal cancers have no symptoms in the beginning. This makes screening important. Liu said often colorectal cancer doesn't cause symptoms until it's grown or spread, and that's why we recommend screening, so colon cancer can be detected at an early stage when it's more treatable and can be curative. Symptoms of colorectal cancer can include a change in bowel habits, rectal bleeding, cramping or abdominal pain, weakness and fatigue, iron deficiency anemia, unintentional weight loss. And finally, ask your doctor. Talk to your family doctor about recommendations for colorectal cancer prevention. For more information, go to genesishealth.com/gastro. The author, Linda Barlow, is a division's communication manager for Genesis Mercy One. Carol?
And it is now time for obituaries. The first obituary today is from Iowa City for Craig Allen Borchardt, 65, of Iowa City, who passed away at Sterlingshire of Coralville on February 20th, 2024. Cremation has taken place and no services are planned at this time. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Croix Hospice. Craig was born to Robert Paul and Carol Ann Basola on December 19, 1958, in Yokohama, Japan. He had two brothers, Bob and Steve, and his family grew as both parents remarried, adding stepsister Jill Shibley and half-sister Jill Horseman to the mix. After graduating from Bettendorf High School in 1976, Craig attended Iowa State University. He left Iowa State to attend the University of Iowa in Iowa City, where he received a bachelor's degree in graphic arts. During his time at the University of Iowa, the student union became an important hangout for Craig and his friends. Craig put together ads for the Iowa Memorial Union bookstore. He also worked at Magoo's Bar and did all their ads. Craig married Georgia Ann Evans on August 11, 1984, at Danforth Chapel. Craig stayed in Iowa City and worked as a buyer for Hawkeye Food Service. Outside work, Craig and his friends liked to spend time at Shakespeare's, where Craig would often play pool. He was a Cubs fan, loved the Minnesota Vikings, and enjoyed playing golf. He also took joy in his dogs. Craig and George Ann enjoyed travel. One of their favorite places was Hawaii, a journey they made 4 different times. Another favorite trip was to visit the wine and olive regions of Italy. Craig is survived by his wife, George Ann, siblings Bob Borchardt of Virginia, Stephen Borchardt of Connecticut, Jill Shibley of Virginia, and Jill Horseman of Florida, stepmother Judy Borchardt of Houston, and nieces and nephews. Craig was preceded in death by his father, mother, and stepfather Ken Horseman.
Michael J. Seibel, October 30th to 1973 to February 29th, 2024. Michael J. Seibel, age 50, of Bettendorf, passed away Thursday, February 29th, at the Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 6th, at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. on Thursday at the funeral home. The family asks that those attending wear motorcycle attire in honor of Mike. Memorials may be directed to the family. Mike was born October 30th, 1973, in Davenport to Barbara Siebel and James Felton. He worked as a production associate for over 11 years at Arconic. Mike enjoyed working on vehicles and riding motorcycles. Those left to honor his memory are his mother, Barbara Cutcombe of Davenport, his father, James, and spouse Rhonda Felton of Missouri, his children, Matthew Siebel of Davenport and Brandon, and spouse Brittany Beaver of Ames, Iowa. One grandchild that's on the way. Siblings, Harold Cutcomp Jr. of Horizon City, Texas, Brandon and spouse Dawn Cutcomb of Palm Coast, Florida, Jennifer and spouse Samuel Foley of Davenport, Christopher and spouse Crystal Cutcomp of Horizon City, Texas, Desiree Cutcomp of Davenport, Glenn Eaton III of Davenport, Melody Felton of Davenport, and James Felton of Missouri, and numerous nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his stepfathers, Glenn Eaton II and Harold Cutcomp, grandparents Cecil and Margaret Seibel, his uncle Bruce Seibel, and great-uncle Raymond Seibel. Online condolences may be shared with Mike's family at McGinnisChambers.com. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. We also have 4 pending funerals. The first is for Emily Matherly, 73, of Coal Valley, Illinois, who died Saturday, March 2nd, 2024, at Allure of the Quad Cities, Moline, Illinois. Funeral arrangements are pending at Trimble Funeral Home, Coal Valley. Alex Achenbach, 84, of rural Mechanicsville, died Saturday, March 2nd, 2024, in his home from heart issues. Arrangements are pending with Fry Funeral Home in Tipton. Inez Kathleen Gustafson, 95, of Moline, Illinois, passed away peacefully Saturday, March 2nd, 2024, at Methodist Medical Center in Peoria, Illinois. Arrangements are in the care of Wint Funeral Home in Moline. And the final is for Diane K. Henry, 89, of Maquoketa, Iowa, who passed away on Tuesday evening, February 27th, 2024, at Jackson Ridge Health Care Center in Maquoketa. Arrangements are pending at Carson Celebration Life Center in Maquoketa.
Turning now to the opinion page of this morning's Quad City Times, The Fate of Ukraine. Brave nation can win if U.S. does 3 things. This first article by Peter Doran, who is a senior adjunct fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He wrote this article for InsideSources.com. 10 years into Russia's long war against Ukraine, which included the illegal annexation of Crimea, far too many Americans are falling prey to a destructive idea. They needlessly believe that Ukraine's defeat is unavoidable. These Americans have lost their bearings. Defeat is never inevitable so long as the nation is willing to fight. George Washington proved this when he crossed the Delaware River. His army refused to quit and America prevailed. In 2024, the United States can enable Ukraine to win by making three crucial changes that Russian President Vladimir Putin will detest. But first, let's bust some myths. Outgunned and outnumbered armies routinely overcome larger opponents. The Taliban outlasted Russia and the United States in Afghanistan. Ho Chi Minh defeated America and France in Vietnam. Another myth is Russia's inexhaustible pool of manpower. Neither Russia nor Ukraine have yet to fully mobilize their populations. Kiev may take this course soon, but it will only harden its population's resolve. Ukrainians know if they stop fighting, they face violent national extermination. They are highly motivated as a result. Meanwhile, Putin fears fully mobilizing his people. He has steadfastly avoided this step despite Russia's catastrophic losses. Instead, the Kremlin has replaced its casualties in Ukraine with the country's provincial poor, its psychopaths, and its prisoners. Some Russians are sounding off. They do not want their husbands and sons to die in Putin's Ukrainian meat grinder. Russian polls confirm this view among the wider population. Total mobilization in Russia could imperil Putin's rule. So Putin is betting on Western weakness. His strategy anticipates that befuddled Western leaders will tire of the war and appease him. We can and must prove Putin wrong. Here's how. Define victory for the U.S. The United States must provide a clear and compelling definition of victory in Ukraine that advances our national interests. The requirement of this victory include the Russian military ceasing to kill Ukrainians, departing Ukrainian territory, and not threatening the existence of the country in the future. The Biden administration hasn't explained what victory should look like to the American public. It is an astonishing dereliction. Second, apply strict sanctions. We must also strangle the Russian war machine. America's rhetoric on Russian sanctions is very different from reality. Moscow is exploiting the economic and oil loopholes that we created for them. We need to close the pipeline of money that is flooding into the Kremlin's coffers. And third, send arms faster. Finally, Congress must approve funding to keep Ukraine in the fight, including robust training for its soldiers. Meanwhile, the White House must end its maddening policy of too little too late arms releases to Kyiv. Russia will not stop with Ukraine. If we fail to enable Ukraine's victory today, we invite endless conflict in Europe tomorrow. Ukrainians have demonstrated their willingness to die for their freedom. By making these three critical changes, Ukraine can and will win.
And the next opinion is by Joe Bassino, a research analyst at the Defense Innovation Board, a former communications director at U.S. Central Command, and a retired U.S. Army colonel. It's entitled, More Money Won't Stop Putin's Cruel Slog. As the second anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of the country to its west passes, and the latest aid package for Ukraine stalls in Congress, we must be clear-eyed about the future. Ukraine has no path to win this war. America's support will not change this reality. 2 years ago, the Ukrainian armed forces defied the expectations immediately. Days before Russia's massive combined arms incursion at dawn on February 24, 2022, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, spoke for the U.S. military when he predicted to Congress that Kyiv would fall within 72 hours. Many military analysts similarly predicted the Russian military would quickly rout the overmatched Ukrainian forces. American leaders encouraged Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to leave the country lest Russian troops assassinate him. These projections of immediate success for Russia misread the progress Ukrainian troops made in capability and readiness since Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea. They also overestimated the Russians' forces' readiness, air superiority, and command cohesion. 1 year ago, the people of Ukraine saw encouraging signs in their gruesome war with Russia. Ukrainian forces were bloodied, but held on to territory in the east. Successful counteroffensives allowed Ukraine to regain territory in the south. Zelensky defiantly declared the coming year one of, quote, our invincibility. American aid into the country offered a king's ransom in artillery and anti-tank weapons. Inspired by Ukraine's stunning success, the West galvanized behind Zelensky and his troops. Tragically, all these indicators led to unrealistic expectations. Today, the situation is grim. The once dynamic fighting has slowed to a cruel slog, one that inures to Russia's favor as Ukraine runs low on troops and munitions, while Russia maintains both. The long-planned, high-risk, months-long Ukrainian spring 2023 counteroffensive failed. Support for Zelensky in Ukraine and the West has finally slipped. American aid is logjammed in Congress. The reality after 2 years of fighting is that Ukraine has no path to victory, not in the sense of pushing Russian troops back to the pre-February 2022 lines of control. Moscow can now throw bodies, tanks, artillery, and drones at the exhausted Ukrainian forces until they crack. Ukraine is outnumbered and struggling to recruit troops. The best Ukraine can do now is fight Russia to a negotiated settlement that allows sovereignty, territorial integrity, and security from another Russian invasion. Even those provisions now seem unrealistic. Russia also has the advantage of time. While Vladimir Putin can lead Russia along a single strategic trajectory regardless of the length of the war, the United States is subject to the whims of democracy. Presidents and members of Congress change hands. Voters grow weary of supporting other countries and policies change. None of this is fair to Ukraine, whose people have placed their hopes of sovereignty on American commitment. But the reality of the situation is tragic. The $60 billion aid package held up in Congress will not significantly change the future. This fight is a long haul that will require additional aid. The spigot will close at some point, perhaps soon, turning off aid and sealing Ukraine's fate. Jeff?
Turning now to sports. Here are events on television for today, on the air. In college basketball, we have Duke at North Carolina State at 6, and at 8, Texas at Baylor, both on ESPN. Weber State at Montana State on ESPNU, also at 8 o'clock. College women's golf is the Darius Rucker Intercollegiate tournament at Hilton Head. That's on the Golf Channel at 1:30 this afternoon. The NBA has three games on schedule. The LA Clippers at Milwaukee at 7 o'clock on NBA TV. On NBC Sports Channel, Chicago at Sacramento at 9. And at 9:30, the Oklahoma City against the LA Lakers, and that's on NBA TV. Hockey, Chicago at Colorado at 8 o'clock on NBC Sports. And spring training baseball has a noon game, Philadelphia versus Toronto. That's on MLB Network. And a soccer game at 2 o'clock, Premier League, Arsenal at Sheffield United. And that's on USA Network. Here's an article about the big day in Iowa City. It's a statement victory. Clark and the Hawkeyes halt Ohio State's winning streak. Caitlin Clark scored 35 points in her final regular season home game, becoming the NCAA's all-time scoring leader in number 6 Iowa's 93-83 win over number 2 Ohio State on Sunday. Hannah Stuhlke scored 23 points and Gabby Marshall added 12 for the Hawkeyes, whose record is 26-4 and 15-3 in the Big Ten. They secured the number 2 seed behind Ohio State in next week's Big Ten tournament. The regular season champion Buckeyes, whose record is 25-4 and 16-2 in the conference, had their 15-game winning streak snapped. Clark said, "I think you can say it's a statement," when she was asked what the win meant heading into the conference tournament. "But more than anything, it's just good momentum for our team going into the Big Ten tournament. You never want to get into the Big Ten tournament on a loss. So I think building off this is really important." Clark, who announced on Thursday that she would enter the WNBA draft after the season, despite having another year of eligibility remaining, made 2 free throws with less than a second left in the first half to eclipse Pete Maravich's 3,667 career points. Clark has 3,685 points heading into the postseason. The Hawkeyes were facing a similar scenario when they finished last season, when they defeated regular season champion Indiana on a buzzer-beating three-pointer by Clark. But there was no need for late drama as Iowa took control of this game in the first half. "This conference is so incredible," Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said. "Two top teams just battling it out right here in the Big Ten." The Hawkeyes went on an 18-3 run in the first quarter to take a 25-10 lead. Ohio State rallied in the second quarter to get within 4 points twice and trailed 44-39 after Ricky Harris' three-pointer with 7 seconds left before a wild sequence of events closed the half. Stuhlke was fouled on a layup attempt with 3/10 of a second left. McMahon was then called for a technical foul after the play for bumping Clark during the dead ball. Stuhlke hit her 2 free throws, then Clark hit 2 to break Maravich's record, and Iowa led 48-39 at halftime. "Hannah stepping up and making 2 free throws was huge," Clark said, "and then I made 2. It kind of takes the air out of them after they just got down and made a layup." The Hawkeyes kept control in the second half, leading by as many as 17 points. J.C. Sheldon led Ohio State with 24 points. Rebecca Mikulcevic-Golova had 14. Taylor Theory had 11, and McMahon and Celeste Taylor each had 10 points. The Buckeyes were out-rebounded 38-31, and Iowa got 16 points off 17 Ohio State turnovers. "We weren't good enough with our transition defense or our rebounding," Ohio State coach Kevin McGuff said. "And we had some really costly turnovers they turned into points. I think that was the story of the game for the most part. It stinks," Sheldon said of the loss, "but now we can focus on getting ready for the Big Ten tournament." Kate Martin added 11 points for Iowa. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And Quad City Storm. Storm ties the franchise road win streak. It was another memorable weekend for the Quad City Storm. Coach Dave Pazinski's crew cruised into Evansville and completed their second straight weekend sweep of an SPHL foe, beating the hosting Thunderbolts 6-3 and 3-2 at the Ford Center. That gave the Quad Cities its first five-game win streak of the season after a three-game sweep of Fayetteville the previous weekend. The five straight road victories also ties a franchise record originally set in the 2021 and 22 season. The overall franchise win streak mark is 10, also set in the 2021 and 22 season. This is October 22nd to November 19th. These last two victories also allowed the Storm to cap a 10-game road trip with an 8-2 record as they moved their season mark to 26-19-0-0, 52 points. That win streak also moved the 6th-place Storm to within 1 point of 5th-place Huntsville, who is 23-16-6-1 and 53 points. Quad City returns home this coming weekend, hosting 10th-place Macon, 12-27-3-3 at 30 points, in games on Friday and Saturday in Vibrant Arena. More franchise history was made in the doubleheader sweep. On Friday, Matt Ustaski recorded a hat trick that moved his season tally to league best 27. That sets a franchise record for single season goals, breaking the old mark held by Shane Bennett, which was 24 during the 2021-22 season, when he added 32 assists for a 56-point season. That is also a franchise record. By stopping 36 of 39 shots in Friday's contest, goaltender Britt Moran recorded his 15th win of the season. That, too, is a franchise record for single-season goaltending victories before he added number 16 on Saturday. That broke Kevin Resop's mark of 14 set last season. In addition to Ustaski's Friday hat trick, Quad Cities also got two goals in that victory from Cole Golka, 23-24, and Patrick's Marcinkiewicz, which is 4. Saturday's 3-2 victory, Golka opened Quad City scoring with his 25th, and Whelan Parrish added his 2nd. That gave the Storm 2-1 lead after the first period. Evansville knotted the score before Captain Tommy Tisco scored his 8th of the campaign that proved to be the game winner at 9:24 mark of the 2nd. Marcinkiewicz picked up 2 assists in Saturday's victory, raising his season total to 11. Trevor Momot assisted on the game winner, giving him 14 helpers this season. While no official transaction has been sent through the league, it was announced on the Storm social media over the weekend that goaltender Bailey Birkin, he's 5-5, 3.14 GAA and .909 save percentage, was returning to the club. He had been part of a trade to Pensacola that has been removed from league transactions. Jeff?
Wrapping up our sports coverage, DeVries and Drake edge Bradley. Tucker DeVries scored 29 points, and Drake beat Bradley 74-66 on Sunday night. DeVries added 6 rebounds and 4 steals for the Bulldogs, whose record is 25-6 and 16-4 in the Missouri Valley Conference. Kevin Overton made 2 three-pointers and scored 13. Colby Garland had 10 points. Malevi Leons led the Braves, who are 21-10 and 13-7, with 18 points, 6 rebounds, and 4 blocks. Duke Dean added 13 points, and Darius Hanna scored 10. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today, Monday the 4th of March, 2024. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockhart. You can listen to Iowa's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.